Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with CNN's John King. Is the do-nothing Congress poised to do something on immigration and minimum wage? And has John Kerry's comment about Israel put his job at risk? Then she offered to resign in February, but the governor said no. Now, after a number of deaths of those under DCF supervision, the governor has accepted Olga Roche's resignation. Was it the right move? Will it fix anything? And then the Globe's Shira Springer on racism in the NBA, sexism in the NFL, and plagiarism at the Boston Marathon.
Here's a new idea. Forget raising the minimum wage. How about setting a maximum wage? And goodbye to all those $100 million-a-year CEOs. Then Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane joins us to talk about whether animal rights protections are enough or whether a chimp, an orca, dolphin, and assorted furry creatures should be able to go into court and sue. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, WGBH. Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
That's right. And another beautiful fall morning in Massachusetts.
Thank you.
So is House Speaker John Boehner straying from the GOP pack? His recent antics suggest he's given more than lip service to pushing an immigration reform bill through the House later this year. And with Congress back in session, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has moved to bring the federal measure on the minimum wage to the floor. But will he have enough political muscle from fellow Democrats to push it even through the Senate alone? Joining us for his take on these and other political headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent and host of Sunday Morning's Inside Politics on CNN. Good morning. Good afternoon, John King.
Good afternoon. It's nice to know that spring has not come to you guys either. It's raining and cold and miserable here.
It's horrible.
Yeah, I'm getting really obsessed with these climate change issues. I'm worried there's going to be no more summer, John. And then what will we do? We'll have to move to, like, I don't know. I don't know where. Anyway, you know, as Jim just said, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is pushing to get this get a debate and maybe a vote even in the Senate on raising the minimum wage, but there's no support for this in the House. So what is this about? Is this a pointless exercise or what?
Well, it's a pointless exercise most likely if your goal is a policy victory. It is not, in the view of Senator Reid and the Democrats, at all a pointless exercise if your point is election year positioning. And look, there's a new ABC Washington Post poll out today that shows the president at 41%. A president in a midterm year with a 41% approval rating is a president about chest, maybe neck deep in quicksand. And so the Democrats want to try to change the subject away from the president, away from health care. And there are some places, if you go race by race, where they think they can do some business, but who's on your side? That you might not like us, you might not like the president, but you should like the Republicans even less. That's the kind of uplifting campaign we're going to have this year. We're all bums, but they're more bums. And on those issues of economic fairness, whether it's equal pay, whether it's the minimum wage, the Democrats do believe by having these votes and getting Republicans on the record, some of them will vote no, in some of these races it could make a difference. So it's about election year politics much more than it is about policy.
Well, speaking of policy and politics, most people in America, their favorite soundbite, I'd say, John, from last week was Donald Sterling with his girlfriend. My favorite soundbite by far is John Boehner, Speaker of the House, talking about immigration in Madison Township, Ohio, over the weekend. Here he is.
I don't know whether we're going to get to it this year or not. I think we should, but the appetite amongst my colleagues for doing this is not real good. And this guy's back here with a camera. But here's the attitude. Oh, don't make me do this. Oh, this is too hard. You should hear him. You know, we get elected to make choices.
So what is this? Obviously, this is born of frustration. But what is he saying? That essentially his own people are the obstacles to necessary change? That's his message, isn't it?
Yes, but he's gone back to the other John Boehner already. He's back in Washington, and he says today that the principal obstacle is that his Republican members don't trust the president on immigration. They don't trust the president to enforce existing law, and they don't trust the president that if they pass new laws that he won't, you know, grant waivers and exemptions like he has on Obamacare. So he's gone back into a Republican talking point, Speaker John Boehner. And actually, both things are true. You know, it's not. This is often I speak about the parallel universe between Washington and the rest of America. This is a case where Boehner does want to do it. In his heart, he wants to do it, and in his politics, he wants to do it because he understands the demographic crisis the Republican Party is in. However, he has both conservative Tea Party grassroots members who say, no way, Mr. Speaker, I can't vote for amnesty. They think it's amnesty. Even a path to status, they think it's amnesty. And then he has more moderate members who, you know, earlier in the year, I think we talked about this last week, didn't want to vote because their primary filing deadline hadn't come up yet. They were afraid if they voted yes, they'd get a primary challenge. Now, most of those deadlines have passed, the filing deadline. And so there's some thinking that you could do it when you got into May and into June, because at that point, you know, if Congressman X casts a vote that might get him a Tea Party challenge back home, it's too late. You can't get in. But from what the speaker says today, it appears that he's still in his no, not going to happen until after the election vote.
Yeah, but let me play naive American here. I'm not playing it. I am naive American here. This sounds to me, based upon what I assume, well, you said both things are true. What he said in Washington and what he said in Ohio is are accurate. It seems, first of all, do Boehner and the president speak to each other anymore, or they don't?
It's been a long time. It's been too long, unless they've had private conversations
okay.
We don't know about. But
okay, so it seems to me, this is the naive American part, that if the chief staff person on the issue for John Boehner met privately with the chief staff person for the president on this issue, that they could strike a deal that would get virtually all the Democrats and enough Republicans that there would be an outcome, something out of the House, and it would surely pass the Senate. So why isn't that happening?
If you brought the Senate bill, the bill that passed the Senate several months ago, if you brought that to the House floor, it would pass.
So why doesn't he do it? If that's where his heart is, why doesn't he? It sounds like he's thinking about his legacy or something or whatever. Good.
Because his own members would revolt against him, and he is, you know, he is the leader of a group. And he does, you have to understand, I'm not agreeing with him, but you have to understand in principle his position on that, you know, I might want ice cream, but everybody else wants yogurt. And I'm outvoted in my group, and he's the leader of a group, and in that sense, you get it. But there's a lot of cynical politics involved here. And look, we just talked about the minimum wage. What are the Democrats doing? They're trying to appease their base. They're trying to excite their base. They're trying to get labor unions and groups that support the Democrats to not only say yay for casting that vote, but yay to giving some money and then doing the organizing and the turnout activities necessary to get people out on election day. If John Boehner wants to gain seats in November, he needs conservative organizations, including groups and organizations that disagree with him on immigration, to rally their members to get out and vote. And, you know, are the Republicans going to lose a ton of seats if they brought that to the floor? I think not. I can't see an analysis that says they lose a ton of seats. Is it possible that conservative enthusiasm would drop some, the base enthusiasm would drop some, and it might put a couple of seats in play? Yeah, but that's the calculation. In the medical community, it's do no harm. In the political community for both parties this year, it's pander to the base.
Yeah, but I see this, John King, a number of times over our radio relationship here. But I always say to myself, maybe this is also naive, that people like John Boehner at this part of the time of their career say, so what do I want? Do I want to get the Profile and Courage Award in 6 years at the Kennedy Library in Boston? Or do I want my political obituary to be the man who presided over the least accomplished Congress in modern American history? Does a guy like that think about those different options or no?
There's no question he would prefer to govern. He, like Mitch McConnell in the Senate, and there are a lot of people out there about to start throwing things at John King, but I believe them, I know them both, to be governing conservatives, meaning they want to govern, mm-hmm. and they don't mind. You know, you cut the best deal and you vote. And you do what you can, and, you know, you make on immigration. We've talked about this for months. Maybe the president wouldn't get citizenship. Maybe the test would Obama accept legal status?
Mm-hmm.
But let's have the vote. I mean, it's like, God forbid, you know, didn't we fight a war a couple hundred years ago, guys in wigs, and, you know, that for this thing called a democracy? Bring it to the floor, vote, and see who wins. Wow, wouldn't that be shocking? But it's not going to happen until after the election. I do think that, look, Boehner's crying like that, mocking his own members, was a sign of legitimate frustration where he feels that, you know, he can't go to the bathroom without permission from the Tea Party guys. I do think if he is reelected Speaker, and there's no serious challenge to him right now, there's a lot of frustration, but there's not a serious challenge to him. If he's reelected Speaker, if the Republicans take the Senate in this election, which is a real possibility, I think Mitch McConnell and John Boehner will move very early in 2015 to cut a deal with President Obama on immigration reform, both because they think it's good policy and because they think for the Republican Party heading into 2016 especially, it's good politics. But are you going to get that done between now and November 2014? In this environment, I just don't see it.
We're talking with John King, CNN's chief national correspondent. John, you just mentioned John Boehner can't go to the bathroom without getting permission from the Tea Party. You talked on your show about how the GOP establishment is spending big, big money to defeat the Tea Party. So is this all of a piece here or what?
It is a piece of it. And the Chamber of Commerce, I reported this on Sunday. They just announced it today. They're going up with ads in five states, in Senate races, and then a sixth state in House races, where they're supporting establishment candidates who face conservative, I'll call them, they're not all Tea Party challenges, but more grassroots conservative, you know, anti-establishment, dump McConnell, dump Boehner kind of guys. And definitely vote no on legal status or path to citizenship kind of guys. And it looks like at the moment, looks like Mitch McConnell will survive his primary, which is a month from now. The one to keep an eye on, the biggest one, is Mississippi. Thad Cochran, a veteran Republican senator there, he's got the toughest of the primary challenges. There are a couple others, but it does look like we might come out of the primary season with establishment, you know, 6 or 8 and Tea Party 0. Now, if that happens, the question is, what is the end result? There's no question McConnell and Boehner would feel emboldened, and they would say, okay, we win. But remember, you still have, let's assume, for the sake of this argument, let's assume the Republicans win the Senate. If they win, McConnell's going to have 51 or 52, maybe 53. He still can't get anything done. And so not only does he have to get the Democrats, but he's got to get Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Mike Lee and the Tea Party guys in his own caucus to agree to do anything. So even if the establishment beats the Tea Party in every one of these primaries, and even if the Republicans gain a few seats in the House and get the majority in the Senate, it's not a clear path to governing. You would give them a majority, they would be inclined to cut deals with the president, but they would still have problems from the remaining Tea Party guys who would be mad for getting thumped.
Well, we always talk about these gerrymandered districts, which enable a lot of very conservative Republicans, Tea Party Republicans, to keep getting reelected. So these Congress people aren't threatened in those districts, are they, or are they?
No, there's very few of them. I mean, you have a couple of we had a guy in Louisiana who just had to retire because he got caught on camera kissing one of his aides.
Oh, yes.
A guy in New York, in a competitive district in New York. It's a Republican district, but it's not a 100% Republican district. Michael Grimm is now under indictment, Staten Island, Brooklyn area. He says he's going to stay. We'll watch, give that one a couple weeks, see if his fundraising dries up, and then the leadership might try to nudge him aside. But no, if you're a Republican in the House, with the exception of about 15 or 20 districts in this country, and this is the crime of our democracy right now, the cancer on our democracy, is that there are so few competitive House districts. And so if you're in a Democratic district, you're really, 90% of the time your only worry is a primary challenge. If you're in a Republican district, 90% of the time your only worry is a primary challenge. And so that's why these guys keep tacking to the right in these districts, because the Democrats are not going to beat them in November. If you're in a Republican district, the only way you're going to get beat is if you do something that, gets a Tea Party challenger and then some outside group with a lot of money to decide, yeah, let's go in and take that guy out.
Hey, John King, speaking of members of the House and House leadership, I want to broach with you another situation where a leader said something and then stepped back a little bit. Kathy McMorris Rodgers, who's a congresswoman from Washington State, I think she's the chair of the GOP conference. Did she give the response to the State of the Union? Is that where she's most? That's right. She apparently said in an interview with an editorial board for a Spokane, Washington newspaper that the repeal of Obamacare was, quote, unlikely, basically making it sound we're going to move on to reform it, to fix it, but we're not, repeal is off the table. And of course, she immediately says, well, what I meant was we'll continue to work to repeal it at every opportunity. Was she in front of that editorial board speaking the truth about how the Affordable Care Act is perceived amongst Republican leadership in the House now, even though they continue to vote to repeal the thing for, I assume, the same sort of reason why the Senate is about to vote to raise the minimum wage, even though it's not going anywhere? Was she speaking the truth for them?
She was speaking the truth. Just like Speaker Boehner was speaking the truth at home, she was speaking the truth to that editorial board in this context. Look, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, call it what you will, it passed the Congress in 2009. So The Republicans have voted more than 50 times in the House to repeal it. And, of course, you have a Democratic president. The guy's name is signatures on the bill, and his name is on it with shorthand. We call it Obamacare. You have a Democratic Senate. It is not going to happen. Let's assume, again, hypothetical, huge Republican wins this year and a Republican wins in 2016, right, the presidency, and comes in office in January 2017. At that point, the law is on the books for 7 years, 8 years. You don't repeal. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. It changes everything. You know, it rewrites health care. It changes the insurance industry. It changes your relationship with your doctors. All the political turmoil that Republicans are benefiting from right now, right? They're going to win some elections. The president's numbers are down in part because of the economy, but in part because of Obamacare. So you're in this environment where you saw what passing this law did to the political environment. You're going to be the guys who repeal it? And risks putting yourself in the same kind of tumult and turmoil and uncertainty and frustration and anger. Right now, if you get an insurance bill, even if it's your insurance company's fault, you blame Obama. That's why Republicans are benefiting, because it's all now everybody thinks this happened because of the president's health care law. So even things that have nothing to do with Obamacare, when they happen, people are getting mad at the politicians. You think the Republicans are going to risk that?
Yeah.
That it's going to be turn on them? It's not going to happen. This is like the conversation. But that doesn't mean they can't significantly change it. But it's just, it is almost, and so it's almost ludicrous to think you're going to be able to repeal something that will have been on the books for years, that the insurance industry, which is largely, you know, sometimes gives a lot of money to the Republican Party, will have adjusted to. This is such a huge slice of the economy. We will have gone through this transition.
Right.
Really? Now you're going to flip it all over again? It's not going to happen.
You know, you remind me of something people always say about pro-life Republicans, that many of them really don't want the law to change, because then they'd have to deal with a nightmare of some tragedy happening to a 17-year-old little blue-eyed blonde from Minnesota or something. It's better to be on the other side. But I want to ask you something about Obama's numbers, John King. You mentioned that they're down 41%, largely because of the economy and Obamacare. I just wondered, how does that compare? George Bush was not very popular at the end of his term over, you know, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, some other things. Is Obama in significantly worse shape, about the same, significantly better?
He is slightly better right now than George W. Bush was on Election Day. A lot of Democrats got mad at me when on State of the Union night I said Obama is Bush, meaning that on State of the Union night in 2006 and on State of the Union night for President Obama in 14, W and Obama were at the same exact point.
Okay.
On Election Day 2006, George W. Bush's approval rating was 38%. And the Democrats won 30 seats in the House, and Nancy Pelosi became Speaker. Obama now is at 41% in the ABC Washington Post poll, a little bit higher in some other polls. Don't overinvest in one poll. But what does it tell you? It just tells you that, as I said earlier, this is a guy, whether you like him or you don't like him, he's in quicksand right now.
Okay.
And when you're in quicksand, you start, you know, your feet start running around. You're trying to find a rock. You're trying to find something to get a hold on. If you can't find one, you keep sinking because you're stirring up the quicksand. And right now, this he is just trying and trying and trying. Tried on this overseas trip to get an accomplishment or two. Sometimes that's how a second-term president, you know, gets his footing. Couldn't get anything. Here at home, the biggest problem is not the health care law. I know that's what the Republicans focus on. It's that 7 in 10 Americans think the economy is either stagnant or getting worse. No president can start to move his numbers up if people think, you know, the economy is just in a fog. And that's what most Americans think. Only in this ABC Washington Post poll, 28% of Americans, so just over a quarter, think the economy is getting better. That's what's holding him down. And if he cannot change that, and then you have the dissatisfaction with the health care plan, and then you have the overall bipartisan, almost universal disgust with Washington, how does the president improve his standing? Because he's part of all those things. He's the CEO of the economy. He's the guy whose name's on the health care bill. And he's the most important person in Washington. And people are mad at all three.
You know, when you say next time you use that line, you say he's Bush, you can say he's Bush, but he can't paint. That's the only thing I'd add to your little list there. Hey, John, you mentioned about maybe one of the ways you rescue yourself, the president, is a foreign policy accomplishment. One might argue that he had a little bit of a setback. Here is Secretary of State John Kerry speaking at a closed-door meeting with world leaders in Washington on Friday. It's hard to understand, but I'll read you his exact words right after.
The unitary state winds up either being an apartheid state with second-class citizens, or it winds up being a state that destroys the capacity of Israel to be a Jewish state. state.
And for those listening, a unitary, this is John Kerry speaking about Israel, obviously, a unitary state winds up either being an apartheid state with second-class citizens or winds up being a state that destroys the capacity of Israel to be a Jewish state. Since that, John Kerry has walked back the comments that I would have chosen a different word, but he's obviously talking about the two-state solution thing. How much damage has this done to John Kerry, and does it put him at any risk for his job?
Well, you know, Ted Cruz says he should give the president his resignation. I can't see that happening right now. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has come out and defended Secretary Kerry, saying that throughout his career in the United States Senate and as Secretary of State, even though they've disagreed sometimes, that he's never doubted Secretary Kerry's support for the state of Israel. Look, but at this, if you're trying to force Netanyahu to do something hard, Netanyahu just got a ton of leverage over you because yeah. The Secretary of State is now embarrassed and the president of the United States is now embarrassed by what happened. Here's the hard part. John Kerry should know better. This is the exact conversation that is happening on the Israeli street. Just like we're talking about Obamacare around the political water cooler every second of every day, they're talking about this. Because the younger generation of Palestinians and some Israelis say, you know what, there should be a two-state solution, but if we're not going to get one, forget about it. Why? We've been at this for 50 years and we can't negotiate a peace deal, so why don't we just have a one-state solution and give the Palestinians equal voting rights in Israel? That's what Secretary Kerry is referring to, because if you do that, then you don't have a Jewish state, do you? Because the Palestinians, without the Arabs and the Palestinians combined, would outnumber the Jews. So what he's trying to say is, listen, if you want to have a Jewish state, you've got to negotiate a two-state solution. You've just got to get over it, or else you have a second-class citizenship. That's what he's talking about. But he can't say that. Ehud Barak can say that. Tippi Livni can say that. But he can't. An American Secretary of State can say you'll have two-class citizens, look at the demographics, the Palestinians will outnumber the Jews, but you can't use the term apartheid. You just can't. He should have known better, and he should have known that there's no such, you know, if after 47% of Mitt Romney, all of us don't realize exactly. That every word we say is being recorded,
yeah.
We should be slapped around a little bit, because there's just nothing that's private in the world anymore because of these little technological devices everybody has.
We're talking with John King from CNN. You know, John, our I guess she's a senior senator now.
She is
a senior senator. Elizabeth Warren is on our book tour with her new book, Fighting Chance. You were talking about how people are very discouraged about the economy. For my money, Elizabeth Warren is tapping into a lot of people's anxiety about the economy, whether it's that they're underwater with these college loans, or kids are underwater with these college loans, whether it's her now cliched, but, you know, truth to it, the middle class getting hammered. There's a lot of excitement for her from the Democratic left. Is this about these economic issues?
I think without a doubt that's part of it, because they see her as someone who has stood up to the big institutions, stood up to the big banks, occasionally stood up to the government. Look, people, this distrust of government extends to distrust of just about every big institution, including the news media, mind you,
yeah.
Which is why a lot of people, you know, aren't paying attention much to us or don't trust us. She stands up and fights for the banks, and she's, you know, in the view of the liberal base or the labor union folks or those who are still struggling or those who got foreclosed on, who don't think it was any of their fault out of the financial crisis, you know, she is speaking truth to power. And that has great appeal, especially at a time when people think, and there's good reason for them to think, that I keep getting screwed and the banks keep getting richer. Or why is it easy for them and so hard for me? Or why can the big businesses get all this financing, but I can't to start a new business or to refinance my home because I'm a little underwater, or because in 2008 and 2009 I got behind on my bills and now I've got a scar on my life, even though for the 30 years before that I did absolutely nothing wrong. So, she speaks to people and they say damn straight when they see her kicking. Now, there's got to be a policy prescription behind the kicking, and Senator Warren, if she runs for higher office, is going to have to explain the rest of it. But she has huge appeal on the left right now.
You know, John, before we let you go in a minute, you mentioned people should be smart enough in 2014 to know there's no such thing as a private conversation anymore. And you obviously cited Romney and the 47% and then John Kerry, this apartheid comment. Just quickly, what's your reaction to the whole mess with the owner of the Clippers, Donald Sterling, and his comment about blacks?
A couple quick things. Let me start going backwards. I'm grateful that Doc Rivers is there, a class guy, an African-American, a player, former player, and a coach with a class guy who's won a championship to help his players through this, because this is the kick in the teeth to his players, who are mostly African-American. Don Sterling is not only a racist, he's an idiot. because to the point you just made, if you listen to this conversation, it's she's baiting him. No, yeah. Say more, Don. No, say more, Don. And he keeps going. Instead of saying, you know, I'm going to hang up. There's something weird happening in this conversation. I think I'm just going to hang up now. He's a racist. He's an idiot for not hanging up the phone. And now a team that has been horrible for years is suddenly good, has this crisis on his hands. I'll close with this. As a journalist, I have a conflict of interest here. This is John King, the human being, speaking. Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, has been a friend of mine for more than 10 years.
Really?
You will not find a more fair, decent, thorough person on planet Earth. He's a damn good lawyer, but more than that, he's just a man of amazing character. He will do whatever he can to fix this. He doesn't have a lot of power at his disposal. You can't fire an owner. But he will use every lever he has to make this right. And he may not be able to do it all today when he makes his announcement today. This may take time, and I'm sure that if he doesn't do it all today, there'll be some criticism of him. But I've never met a finer human being than Adam Silver. And I've talked to him briefly about this. I can't disclose those conversations. It's their friend conversations. He'll do the right thing. That I trust 1,000%.
Well, that's quite a recommendation.
John King. That is quite a recommendation,
Good to talk
John.
To you.
Thank you.
Speak next week, John.
Take care, guys.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent and host of Inside Politics, which you can watch Sunday mornings at 8:30, and it's a great show, and he's a great reporter. Up next, with pressure mounting from the public and the state legislature, Governor Patrick is looking for a new person to head the Department of Children and Families. He seems to have found the interim person, at least. Is this all, though, too little, too late? Are we getting fixated on the symbolism of a leader stepping down? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
In California's historic drought, where can farmers find water? Well, in one part of the state, some turn to the oil industry.
You have tremendous water resources that are a byproduct of oil production.
Water recycled from fracking and the controversy that comes with it. That story today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. What a difference a couple of months makes. Here is Governor Deval Patrick talking to us in February about whether or not he was going to ask Olga Roche, the Commissioner of the Department of Children and Families, to step down.
Yeah, but I will tell you, as I have told her, if I thought it served the best interests of the children to ask for her resignation, I would ask for her resignation. I don't think it does.
Has she offered it to you? Has she said to you, if you don't have confidence in me, Governor, I'll just step down?
Yeah, she's been very clear about that.
She has.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's been clear about it.
But he didn't accept her resignation at the time. Obviously, as you know, that all changed this morning when he announced that she had offered to resign and he had accepted it. You're all familiar with the problems, children dying under the supervision of DCF in very high-profile ways over the last few months, including little Jeremiah Figueroa and then a couple of infants in the last week. We want to know where you are on this. Has this been a forcing out of Commissioner Roche in slow motion? Will this change anything, or is it just one of those classic pound of flesh kind of things? I should say, I really speak for Marjorie. I am one who thinks it was the absolutely necessary and right thing to do for reasons very similar to what the governor said this morning, which I'll share with you. And you, Marjorie, think it essentially fixes virtually nothing, right?
I think it fixes virtually nothing.
Why?
Because Governor Patrick's term is almost over. This person that he's appointed is at best an interim person that's going to come in and hold the seat warm until a new administration comes in with a whole new department. I guess my big frustration with the Department of Social Services, now the Department of Children and Families, is that, you know, when I was a young reporter, I started writing about them, and The same problems were true then as are true now. There is not enough money. You cannot possibly take care of children when you have 20 and 25 and 30 children on your caseload. And by the way, that's not just a child. That's the whole family.
Sure.
So
no, yeah, I understand.
We just have no commitment to it. And the other big problem of the department, and I think the biggest problem is that they have no money. And they lost $100 million in their budget, by the way. $850 million was their budget. It was down to like $736 million between 2007 and 2011, which really showed how much we cared about it, which is very little. We pay these social workers starting out $40,000, which is very little money. They have very difficult working conditions. They operate in a culture of secrecy, which is another big problem. So there's no way of knowing. And they're allowed to do this. They're allowed to say, when you ask them basic questions like, how many criminals are living in foster homes? Well, we can't tell you because that's a violation of privacy. So the problems that were there 30 years ago are there now. And we just roll through these commissioners without any real commitment to fixing it.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Everybody has been following the travails of the Department of Children and Families over the last couple of months, particularly since it was learned that they lost track of Jeremiah Figueroa months before it became clear, thanks to his little sister, I think, telling a teacher that he had been missing. I agree with virtually every single thing Marjorie said, with one huge exception. It was the right thing. It will make a difference. And Governor Patrick, I have to say, even though he did this reluctantly, if you listen to what he had to say this morning, he's a reporter says Patrick and the head of Health and Human Services, John Polonowicz, were the only ones who wanted to keep Olga Roche. Everybody else in the Commonwealth wanted her gone. Listen particularly to what he says near the end of this, which is exactly what I think was the issue.
Well, you're wrong that everybody in the Commonwealth wanted her gone. A lot of people were calling for a resignation, again, without making the connection between failure and fault, and that ought to matter. It certainly matters to me. This is somebody with over 30 years of experience in this agency, a lot more experience than me and you, and most people. But without being able to get to command the confidence of the public and of her agency, then they're never going to get the benefit of the doubt to move through a tragedy to the next triumph.
By the way, I think that is totally the issue. I think you may have had the only one-on-one interview with Olga Roche that any reporter in Greater Boston or New England had, and I'm interested to hear what you thought of her when you did that. But he's right. But without being able to command the confidence in the public and her agency, etc. Months ago, I said to you, I think Kathleen Sebelius had to step down because of the problem with healthcare.gov, not because I have any evidence. She's not a competent person. She was a well-regarded governor. People thought she was pretty competent, quite competent at Health and Human Services. The public lost confidence in the ability of this administration, to do the Affordable Care Act. The public has lost confidence, fairly or unfairly, in the ability of DCF to protect children.
But when he
the
says,
head has got to go.
When he says it's going to make a difference in the care of these children, or you say it's going to make a difference in the care of these children, it's not going to make a difference
I don't agree
in the
with
care
that.
Of these children. Well, I don't think it's going to make
if
any difference at all.
It engages
and you know what else?
The public.
You know what else?
What's that?
You know what else? Here's another problem, which is insolvable the way that the things are set up now. Who appoints the new head of the Department of Social Services, Department of Children and Families? Who appoints them?
Governor?
The governor, that's right.
Yeah.
So the person that runs the agency is never going to tell the truth about the problems of the agency because it's going to reflect badly on the person that appointed he or she. And by the way, now we have a person that was a lifelong social worker, Olga Roche, who seemed like a very, very nice person.
Was she a good manager?
Well, I would say she was very unimpressive in the interview I had. I hate to criticize her, but she seems like a lovely person, but she didn't seem to get the problems. And the problems were that the social workers were totally off the reservation and didn't check on this young little boy who wound up, as we all know, his little body was found and he's dead and probably murdered at the hands of his mother and stepfather. But the thing is, so she was a lifelong social worker. Angela McCain, the guy that was there before, was a social worker. Actually, he was a foster child himself. Previous to that, you had Harry Spence, who was a lawyer, who was like Mr. Fix-It, who gets appointed to these government agencies to fix them up. No social work experience at all. Many people think he was the best head of the department that they ever had. He was driven out of town on a rail because a child died and was mistreated. Children are going to die in this agency because of the terrible situations. The question should be, is the agency doing everything it can to try to prevent tragedies which are going to happen, or are they not? And I think that we never really find out if that's true because of the cloak of secrecy that surrounds them. And again,
well, except that people like you who have written, I have to say, brilliantly and relentlessly about these issues for a couple of decades.
I did years
excuse
ago.
Me. What you should do, because half of the problem, in my estimation, apparently not yours, has been. By the way, I said Jeremiah Figueroa, it's Jeremiah Oliver.
Jeremiah
my apologies.
Oliver.
Thank you, my colleagues. Half the problem has been solved. The other half, as you say, is caseloads and salaries. Why is Olga Roche gone? Because the Democratic Speaker of the House took action, and then finally, one of my least favorite public officials,
me, the Democratic Speaker of the House said money was not an issue. To me, I like Bob DeLeo.
Excuse me, can
no
I finish a sentence?
Credibility on
is
this.
Why is Olga Roche gone today, Marjorie? I didn't speak about his past. Why is she gone today?
She's gone today because he said yesterday.
Exactly.
She had to go.
And now it is incumbent upon everybody who says they care about these kids, including you and a lot of advocates in the public, to say, you've done half the job. You've given the public their pound of flesh because they weren't confident. Now do the other half of the job, which has been undone for, as you say, 3 decades, reduce caseloads dramatically, and pay these people a decent wage. Now, they own this thing now. It is no longer just Deval Patrick. They own this thing. And you're right. Bob DeLeo did say it was not a money issue, but he subsequently said, including to me, if money is a problem, then we're going to find money for it. And now they have to do it. But the notion that even if they fix the caseload problem, Marjorie, and even if they fix the salary problem, that this agency could ever restore the public's confidence with this woman atop it is ridiculous. She had completely she was the symbol of the ineptitude and the tragedy at DCF.
But once again, this is because there's been so much criticism of this woman, and probably deserved because I don't think she's much of a manager. It is not going to make any difference in the lives of these kids between now and the next.
If they don't do anything else, I agree.
It's just going to be the same. They have, we should say, put money in the budget after this Jeremiah Oliver situation to hire more social workers. But again, it's what they do every time. Harry Spence had a great idea when he was running the department, which is
he's now running the courts, right? Is he the civil administrator of the court system or something?
I don't know. Mr. Fix It in all these different agencies. And one of the things he wanted to do and did to some degree when he was running the department was to have it not just be one social worker going out to one family. And a lot of these social workers are very young and do not have a lot of training trying to make these life and death decisions. He would have groups of social workers. And that's
like
good.
And
I should say just a couple of things. You know, it's not a total disaster at the Department of Children and Families. They have done one thing that's really important. They have increased their rate of adoptions so that children do not languish indefinitely in the system. They don't get adopted fast enough, but they've made vast improvements. They should get some credit for that.
877-301-8970. So the governor took action this morning, accepted the resignation of Olga Roche. This Erin Devaney, who I must admit I never heard of, I'm assuming she's internal, is now the interim commissioner. Is this a step in the right direction? Or as Marjorie says, this essentially fixes nothing, and we're going to get nothing fixed until there's a new administration with a permanent head. I think if the legislature follows this up with some serious action on the financial front, that we will get action and we will get improvements, and this starts that ball rolling. 877-301-8970 is the phone number.
Allie in the car, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. What do you think, Allie?
Hey.
Hi, guys. I know that this is a super sensitive subject, but as a graduate student in social work school, I had to call you guys. In my policy courses at a fine institution, we've been talking a lot about the language that has been used. And I think that using social workers as an umbrella term for the counselors and the support that are being used in these services is doing a disservice to the, you know, licensed clinicians out there. And I just had to call and give that piece because it's been, you know, it's close to home for me, this whole situation. And I just think that throwing around the word
what do you mean? What do you mean, Allie, that they're not adequately trained to be called social workers?
Well, right, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that a social worker is a kind of a catch-all term for anybody that works in, you know, human services. And it's a super sensitive subject to me because I'm spending an astronomical amount of money to become a licensed clinician. And I'm not going to be getting paid that much, as you guys mentioned. And I know that you said, Marjorie, that there's limited training out there, but there are people who do have licenses whose, you know, field placements were in DCF, or they do have great mentors in the field. And I just think that people can get certificates in social work and go be social workers.
Hey, Ali, yeah. Before you go away, though, in addition to making your point quite well, since you are in the field, what do you think of the decision of the governor to accept the resignation of Roche?
I think that it was a wise decision on his behalf, and I listened to his speech this morning, and I think that he understands both sides of it. But, I mean, there's so many children, and the numbers are just too high. And, you know, the Jeremy Oliver case, he's so little and just not, you know, having watchful eyes on these people. It's just a disservice, and it's not right. It's not ethical.
Ali, thanks for the call. Good luck with your career. We appreciate it.
You know, I should give some credit to Aaron Smith and Matt Stout. They've done great reporting on the Department of Children and Families for the Herald. And one of the things that they discovered in their reporting is that there are many, many social workers, I'll put it in quotes, given Ali's points, who aren't licensed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's needless to say.
And, you know, problem. It bears that, you know, the governor, whenever he's here, has gone out of his way. And I admire this in him, because the only time we ever focus on government is when it's doing something poorly. As you've written, the vast majority of these people work like dogs under incredibly difficult conditions.
And some of them
foster
are wonderful.
Parents get trashed. The vast majority, and, you know, though they're only in it for the money, the vast majority of the foster parents are doing an expression I almost never use, God's work, are really incredible souls. But the problem is you have to fix the outlying cases when little boys and little girls lose their lives.
Well, you know, the classic line, and I forget who said it first, but it might have been one of the commissioners, say there's only two things we do wrong at DSS or DCF. We leave children with their families, or we take children away.
That's a great
so
line.
So this is just so – I just got two emails, one from Michael, I believe, who was blaming DSS for leaving kids with their – I shouldn't keep calling it DSS. It's DCF now. Blaming DCF for leaving kids with bad families. And then the second person pointing out that all these children, these recent tragedies, have been children that were with their families, and that foster care is wonderful and they do great work. What DCF tries to do now is put kids with their relatives if they can, which
right.
I think is a good idea. Because like anything else, some of these parents are terrible parents. Some of these foster parents are terrible parents. There are some great foster parents and some great parents, obviously, that are just poor.
You know, the other thing, let me just say one more thing about the debate you and I are having about the Olga Roche being the sacrificial lamb, for lack of a better expression. You know, I'm obsessed with the lack of accountability in our culture.
Right.
The other day, the prime minister of South Korea resigned because his contention was that the government didn't respond quickly enough to the ferry disaster. Remember that guy in the Philippines who said that if I don't have all the power on, by I think it was Christmas or something, I'm going to resign.
Right.
It was like 98% on. He offered his resignation, was rejected. This is accountability. If you're the boss, if you're Kathleen Sebelius, if you're Olga Roche, even if you did the best job you can, if it doesn't work, then the answer is you have to be held accountable for this thing. And I think that's all this is. And I think it was the right decision on the part of the governor, or surely it was the right decision on the part of Roche. I'm not sure she voluntarily offered a resignation, but obviously it was what was going to happen. Let's go to
877-301-8970 if you want to weigh in on the resignation and replacement of Olga Roche at the Department of Children and Families. Let's go to Joe in New Hampshire. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great.
Well, I grew up in the system, and I grew up a child of foster care.
Oh, it's perfect. What do you think?
Well, Marjorie, I got to agree with you 100%. I mean, even back then, and that was in like late 70s, early 80s, it was a disaster. I mean, there were these, I don't think it was the people in general who came to, you know, take care of you and put you in different places, but the places where you were put were disasters. And like you said, there wasn't a lot of money. And I think that the system needs to be overhauled. It's not working. Especially, like you said, even now with everything that's going on. And I was in it 30 years ago.
Yeah, they pay, I don't know what the exact rate now, but it's something like $18 a day for a teenager and less for small kids. I could be off by a dollar or two, but that's not very much money, Joe, to raise children.
And I believe that there's just too many kids in the system and not enough workers,
Yeah, well, I think you've hit on it's not enough money, not enough workers, not enough money for foster care parents. And by the way, residential treatment, which works with a lot of older children, particularly children with big-time mental health issues, they never want to do it, or they try not to do it because it's very, very expensive to have residential treatment.
Joe, thanks for sharing your experience. You know what the other problem is? You came close to saying this a minute ago. I think this is where you were going, and then you interrupted yourself or something.
No, I think you interrupted me, Joe.
Maybe so. There's no constituency for these kids. There just isn't. I mean, the reality is, I'm not saying there aren't some advocates and there aren't some good organizations, but in the grand scheme of things, they don't have the power on Beacon Hill to... They don't have the juice, as the expression goes, to get there, as is evidenced by three decades of this mess.
Well, let me get on my feminist high horse here for a second and say this is about families and children. It's not sexy. You're not going to make your career as a reporter reporting about the Department of Children and Families. I learned that the hard way. You're not going to make your career as a politician reporting on them because, again, it's about babies and children and not sexy stuff to a lot of people. But social workers, to me, for the department, they're first responders.
I agree with that.
They're like cops. I agree completely. And they're like firefighters. And they're not – they go in – I mean, when a cop goes into a domestic violence situation, you know what he's got with him? He's got a gun. You have these young social workers going into these essentially domestic violence situations. Well, they are domestic violence situations with their little notebooks. We don't give these people the respect, and we don't treat the department. And, you know, we're all hailing the fact that we have these great agreements and with cops and firefighters in the city of Boston, and that is Boston. It's not the whole state. It's Boston making very, very good salaries. And, again, you look at social workers. Until recently, they were having to provide their own car seats. And you know what else they have to provide?
No.
All these people that have their own cars, all these state workers that get their own cars.
I know, this
to
is
drive
one of your issues. I know, you're right. You're totally
they drive
right.
in their own cars. At least now they do get the car seats. But the car seats I've seen, and some of them are in pretty bad shape.
Let's go to Chris on Cape Cod. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great.
I think that everyone's heart is in the right place here. And change is not something that happens in an instant. It's a process. And it's a known fact that if you don't have leadership that can make change happen and move the rank and file, it'll never happen. And if you don't have a change in leadership, there's no way that people are going to embrace a change in culture.
I think it's true. And by the way, you know, I mentioned, and I only said half of what I should have said when I mentioned the public had lost confidence in Olga Roche. It's pretty clear that the staff had lost confidence in Olga Roche, even though she came from within those ranks, Chris.
Absolutely. I think it's a matter of business. It needs to be. It's not about politics. It's about doing things the smart way. So the change is necessary, and I'm sorry that it's at her feet.
Chris, thanks for calling. We got to let you go only because the connection's bad. You know what I used to tell you? I was a legal services lawyer when I was a kid.
What?
When I was a young lawyer, I was a legal services lawyer. Remember, I've said this to you before. This is the exact same situation here. There was no sense of management being a skill. If you were the legal services lawyer in the office who had served the longest time, you know what you became? The head of the office. You don't necessarily have any management skills. You understood the provision of legal services, but not how to manage other people. Not everybody, but most people with whom I've spoken about Olga Roche, I've never met her.
Right.
Said she was a very caring person, was totally committed. She'd done this for three decades. But it doesn't mean you have the skills to. How many people work at DCF?
But again,
thousands?
But again, they had done that route. They've done the MBA manager type business.
Well, I thought you
person.
Said that was the best. Harry Spence was
well,
the
Harry
best
Spence
they've had in the last three or four.
But going back into the 80s, they hired a woman. Actually, she lives in Brooklyn. I see her occasionally at this supermarket who ran it for a while. Linda, I forget her last name.
I know who you mean.
She ran the agency and she, from a business perspective. And I'm sure there was some tragedy and she was driven out of town.
I'm not saying, by the way, they should have no experience in or around human services. I'm just saying managerial skills when you have a huge agency with a lot of pressure, a lot of scrutiny matters. Laura, you're in Andover. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Hi. I don't necessarily disagree with the firing of Ms. Roche. I'm not sure what was right in regards to that. But my concern is that now that she's been fired, some of that public pressure could come off, sort of like, okay, the problem's been taken care of, so we can move on, when really the problem hasn't been taken care of.
You know, I argue the other side from what you're saying, Laura, that begins the momentum, but unfortunately, you make a very good point.
That's a great point.
For the vast majority of the public, including the media, who's not intimately involved in the everyday goings-on, this may be what convinces them the change came to DCF. And as Marjorie and you were both saying, there's a lot more that needs to be done. Thanks for the call.
Linda Carlisle. Yeah, she was brought in after Governor Weld had his Blue Ribbon Commission to fix the agency and to lower the caseloads and to spend more money. That was, I think.
Did you read the story? And then we brought this up with Charlie Baker. When Charlie was here the other day, we brought it up, this story in the Globe about, because he's been very critical of DCF. He has said Roche, he told us ages ago that Roche is resignation should have been accepted. He's talked about a whole variety of changes he'd made. But some Globe reporter, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his or her name, did an analysis of what was happening when he was the head of Health and Human Services for Bill Weld, some of the same problems. And without laying blame, or not the issue is, as you've said so perfectly, is they were fighting about caseloads. In the 90s, they were fighting about caseloads in the 80s. And so really that part of it, and you may be right, I hope you're not, that that part of it really never changes except along the margins.
And again, the secrecy, it's like, you know, the Kremlin at this agency trying to get information from them.
What's the point you made the last time the governor, two times ago when the governor was here, when you brought up the secrecy thing, as you call it, you said, but it's interesting, when they want to do X, they have no problem with full disclosure. What was the example you were giving?
Oh, when the little boy, the 14-year-old boy, was accused of killing his little brother.
Oh, he was in court yesterday,
in
actually.
Mattapan,
yeah.
Yes. I mean, right away we learned that the family had been in contact with the Department of Social Services. And, you know, so the secrecy thing, 99% of the time, has got nothing to do with
the
protecting
cover
everybody's privacy. Yeah, or it's because they've been allowed to talk about confidentiality in every kind of situation. It's enabled them not to know what's going on. So when the Herald was asking them, we had a great story, again, Aaron Smith and Matt Stout, a great story about criminals in these foster homes. And they asked the Ogorochea, well, how many criminals and what kind of crimes? And they said, well, they couldn't tell them because it was privacy, which was ridiculous. They just wanted the raw numbers. They didn't really know.
But didn't it turn out that some of the so-called criminals were family members, and isn't that one of the reasons why they
yes.
placed them with them, as you said a while ago, even
yes.
though, yeah, okay.
Well, I mean, again, if your uncle was a terrible criminal when he was 20 and now he's 50,
yeah.
You know, then you have to weigh the pros and cons. But you should be able to explain that to people that are skeptical.
Let's squeeze one or two very quick ones in if we can. Susan in Newburyport, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for your call. Hi.
I was just looking at geographically, all these three cases that have gotten all this attention are all in the Worcester area. So there's one office. Maybe they have more cases than anyone else, or maybe there's a drug problem out there, not among the workers, but among families that is causing all this dysfunction. But it's all in one region, all of the cases in the last couple of weeks. And I don't know how I feel about the commissioner resigning, because I always think these things are kind of pasting over a deep problem, but I'm yeah. horrified at DeLeo. The Senate and the legislature has been cutting budgets forever, and they're suddenly horrified that something's not working. It's all I can think of is Claude Rains.
Yeah.
Oh, Captain Renault from Casablanca. We're
it's
shocked.
Great...
We're shocked that gambling is going on here in Rick's Cafe.
Susan,
thank you, Susan.
There is a great variety among different regional offices. That's the thing Charlie Baker was talking
yeah.
about caseloads
yeah.
and the way they're run. So that's a good point. We squeeze one more call here.
One more. That's all.
Jerry
we have time
from
for.
Somerville. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Jerry.
Hi. How you doing? I just want to quickly agree with Marjorie. And also the previous caller, and express my disgust with politicians that forever and ever have been trying to manage a very, very complex and dark, dark issue. Here you have 34,000 of the worst family and child situations in the state?
Yeah, I don't know the number.
And politicians are pointing their finger and yet at the same time not willing to fund this situation. It's like me asking my son, giving him a pair of scissors and ask him to go out and cut, you know, 5 acres of my grass and back. I want to.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Good image, Jerry.
That's beautiful, Jerry.
Unfortunately, I wanted to use the example of a septic tank.
I think the scissors did the job. Jerry, thank you for your call.
You know,
we appreciate it.
Before we go, I just want to say two bright notes. I mean, most of us feel like we could never, ever in a million years be a foster parent because it's just a 24-hour seven. But the department does have these opportunities to be like a big brother or a big sister to kids. And you spend like maybe a couple of hours a month. And I've done stories on some of these, I mean, really wonderful stories, because these mentors, as they call them, are not being paid. And I remember a little kid saying to one of these mentors that he really loved spending time with her because he knew she was the only person in his life who wasn't paid to spend time with him. I know. It makes you choke up just to think about it. So there are these volunteer opportunities that don't take very much time, and they really make such a difference.
But since you brought it up, you know that about a decade ago, I went for the first and only time to the annual ceremony at the State House honoring foster families.
Yeah, a lot of them are great.
Oh, my God.
A lot of them are great.
And the Foster Family of the Year was a family that had something like 300 kids through the years. A bunch of those kids, grown now, were there to speak to this and made you cry. And by anybody, again, as I said 20 minutes ago, anybody who thinks they're doing it for the money, not only is there not enough money, but you should meet some of these people. So the vast majority are really doing incredible things under really difficult circumstances.
Yeah, and they're good people who just, good mothers who just love kids. It's unbelievable.
It's pretty amazing.
Anyway, up next, we're going to be joined on a much cheerier subject. Well, at least part of it anyway.
I don't know how cheery it is.
Actually, maybe it's not cheery at all. Good point. For the Boston Globe, Shira Springer joins us to talk about very uncheery racism in the NBA.
Oh, that's cheery. What's next?
Very uncheerful sexism in the NFL.
That's upbeat.
And plagiarism in the Boston
Marathon. Good.
Okay, sorry. More doom and gloom coming up next with Shira Springer on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org. Should smoking be banned from public housing? It's about to be in Cambridge. If you missed the story on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on? More great stuff on WGBH through our vehicle donation program. Visit WGBH.org/car donation.
Funding for our programs comes from you.
And State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead. Proud to support Innovation Hub, Saturday at 10 a.m. and in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 9 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH. And Boston Conservatory, presenting Joseph Silverstein, former concertmaster of the BSO, in a one-night-only performance, Friday, May 2nd at 8 p.m. For tickets or more information, you can visit bostonconservatory.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And today we're looking at, I guess you could call it the bad, the ugly, and the uglier offenses that are happening in the sports world, from a variation on Rosie Ruiz, if you remember her, to Donald Sterling's racist remarks, which have inflamed the sports world and many of us who have nothing to do with the sports world and beyond. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over the current outrages in the athletic universe is Shira Springer. Shira is the sports enterprise and investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. Hi, Shira.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
Thank you for coming in. So there's going to be a press conference. What time is it going to be?
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock.
About Mr. Sterling's fate. What do you think is going to happen this afternoon, Shira Springer?
My money is on indefinite suspension. And I think a lot of internal pressure will come after that to sort of force him out of ownership. I don't think there are any provisions, real solid provisions, in the NBA Constitution that will allow the NBA to legally force him out of ownership now. And the problem, another problem, is that Donald Sterling is a particularly litigious person. So I think the NBA is somewhat fearful if they make a hard push out of ownership, he'll sue them.
When you mean indefinite suspension, they'll suspend him from what?
Suspend him from any involvement in team activities,
okay,
from attending any of his team's games, from being around any of the team's facilities. Basically, he has to completely remove himself.
It was like Steinbrenner years and years and years ago,
exactly,
with the Yankees, right?
Exactly.
After he had his criminal problems. You know, the new commissioner, we were speaking to John King this morning, who from CNN, who turns out is very close friends with Adam Silver, who's just started the job.
I mean, in February.
Oh, my God, what a way to open the show. He responds to, how many owners are there, 30 or 32?
There are 30.
I'm not totally convinced that the other 29 want something horrible to happen. I assume that was originally Mark Cuban. You and I, before we went on the air, I said, have you ever spoken to Sterling? He said, you've seen him. And you said, he sticks to himself, unlike, and I'm repeating what you said, unlike Mark Cuban, who owns Dallas Mavericks, who chats up everybody. Cuban, who's one of the most outspoken people on the planet, has been very reserved in terms of this. And what I read into it is, hey, wait a second. If they're going to take this team away from this guy because of what he said, as gross as it is, at a private conversation in his house, that ain't so good for me because I said so-and-so or I might say so-and-so. The owners are nervous about this too, right?
Well, I think, yeah, and Mark Cuban has been pretty upfront about this in comments he made, I believe, before last night's playoff game, where he talked about the slippery slope. This
right.
is Donald Sterling having a conversation in the privacy of his home. He has the expectation of privacy, and so constitutionally, U.S. constitutionally, not NBA constitution-wise, you know, you can't just take property away, and that's essentially what the team is for Sterling. You can't take property away for something somebody says in the privacy of their own home. And I think Mark Cuban is rightfully worried that you are creating a precedent, a slippery slope, if you do try to strip Donald Sterling of his ownership. That being said, I think his other Texas owner, the owner of the Houston Rockets, Leslie Alexander, had a very smart and creative solution, and that was let all the Clippers players become free agents when their season is done. Mm. So you're not effectively stripping Donald Sterling of his team, but you're allowing his
good.
Team to go elsewhere.
We're talking to Shira Springer from the Boston Globe.
What about the market, the advertisers? What role are they going to play?
Well, so far, you know, most of them have either, you know, taken a hike and disassociated themselves from the Clippers, and some have sort of quote unquote paused their business relationship.
Uh-huh.
But I believe there are several sponsors, big name sponsors. I think it's Virgin America. CarMax, Kia, State Farm are all sort of stepping away from their sponsorship relationship with the Clippers. Now, if the NBA doesn't react strongly enough at this 2 p.m. news conference, I have to wonder if there are going to be more sponsors that might sort of push away a little bit, or what they're saying creatively, take a pause from their business relationship with other teams. And certainly, you know, players, I think, are going to be watching this, and players are going to also, what happens to the deals that the players have, or the way the players kind of integrate with their sponsorship in the NBA. A lot of them are staging protests. I know that the Dallas Mavericks and the San Antonio Spurs wore black socks. The Miami Heat, like the Clippers did, turned their warm-up jerseys inside out as a form of protest. So I think these next couple of days after the announcement by the NBA, we're going to start to see some shuffling out of how the sponsors and how players react.
Well, there may be some reaction and shuffling out, to use your term, tonight. The Clippers play tonight, right?
Yes.
And there's been a lot of criticism. And actually, I had never, I'm embarrassed to admit, until Irene Monroe yesterday, with passion in our studio, said they shouldn't have played the game. Nobody should have played a game. And at the end of which, I'm shaking my head saying, exactly, you're right. They've taken a lot of heat saying pulling your jerseys off and throwing them in the middle of the floor was about as weak gets. If all that happens, and I know that is value laden by my saying, if all that happens is an indefinite suspension, what do the Clippers do tonight when they take the court? Do they take the court? Some are saying they won't take the court for practice, big deal, for 30 minutes. Is it possible they don't play their fifth out of seven playoff game? What are the options here?
I think if they've played the fourth, they're going to play the fifth, even though it'll be in front of the home crowd
in LA. Oh, tonight is back in Los Angeles?
Tonight will be the first game back in Los Angeles after this all broke on Friday. You know, I think as a player, you're in a particularly tough situation. I think what the players were trying to do by turning their warm-up jerseys inside out and basically taking the Clippers name off of it was to say, we play for each other. There's solidarity among the team. And, you know, that's something Doc Rivers, the coach now of the Clippers, has said as well. You know, this is something we've worked for since the beginning of the season. And it may seem petty to people who don't understand the larger, you know, who don't operate in the sports world, but this is something that, you know, players, they are focused. They were actually one of the favorites. You know, people thought the Clippers had a good chance of winning the NBA title this year. This is something players work their whole career for. So I think there's this, they're torn and they're obviously distracted. If there's just an indefinite suspension, I don't see them boycotting the game, but I do see, and the other alternative, I think the only alternative that would satisfy many of the players would be to force Sterling out of ownership. Short of that, anything's fair game.
We're talking with Shira Springer from the Boston Globe. You know, one of the things you've heard over and over in this controversy is that this should have been no surprise because this guy has a long history, you know, being a landlord, not wanting a minority people to live in his apartments and things he said, et cetera. So kind of where has everybody been?
Maybe you should finish that sentence. And paying a $2.8 million fine.
The largest,
for discriminating against people in his housing based on race, even though there's no admission of guilt. The guy was essentially found liable for this.
And in a way, I think that's somewhat the larger, bigger, more important issue in the sense that the NBA, in a sense, sheltered Sterling for decades. I mean, this is a guy who has owned an NBA team since 1981 when he purchased it, I think, for something like $12.7 million. So he's very much firmly part of the old school of ownership. He's not one of these hedge fund billionaires. And he's, one, always had a reputation for squeezing, you know, as much money, as much profit as he could out of the franchise and shortchanging players, shortchanging coaches, shortchanging general managers. That's just in the basketball operations side. On the other side, he has a long history of, you know, racist behavior documented. And the question is exactly, where was the NBA when all this was going on? And it's now, unfortunately, I hate to say it, a problem that has trickled down to Adam Silver from the old regime, you know, when David Stern was commissioner. But clearly it seems that something should have been done in the decades preceding this when there was clear evidence that he displayed racist and discriminatory behavior.
I'm so glad you said that for a whole variety of reasons, including the fact I know we shouldn't judge comparative racism, but I'll make this point anyway. Which is worse, being found a libel for, even though you admitted no guilt, for discriminating against people of color in housing and making some comments about that I won't even repeat about some of your tenants that are grotesque, or what you said to your girlfriend at age 81. And I'm not saying it's not serious, but I would argue, just as you seem to be arguing, Donald Stern, the prior commissioner, should have dealt with that issue before having to deal with this. But that also raises somebody who I think until yesterday was universally beloved, Doc Rivers. Doc Rivers is no dope. In fact, I've never met him, but I shook his hand once, but I've never spoken to him. He's a really smart guy. I'm assuming before he left the Celtics to go there and take $7 million and he was in demand, he knew everything there was to know. He used to play for the Clippers. So in part, I mean, he can't just separate himself from this and say, you know, I may not come back next year. I didn't take Sterling's call yesterday when he called me to talk. The reality is he's almost an enabler in this situation, as is and particularly somebody like him who had other options since he was in a big demand coach. What's the word on the basketball street about Rivers' behavior and all this? And by the way, he intimated that when the players threw their jerseys down, that may have been too radical a position, that they maybe shouldn't have even done that. What's the view of Rivers today?
Well, first of all, I think just to address one thing is he absolutely, and any player, any general manager, any coach who signs up to play or to be part of the Clippers organization knows full well the history of Donald Sterling. I mean, this is a guy who's had coaches sue him to get their money. So you know exactly what you're walking into. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say he's an enabler, but I think there are some, and I don't want to say hypocritical, but there are some criticism saying, listen, the players, but more specifically, Doc knew. I mean, not only was he walked in with eyes wide open as a coach, he also played right for Donald Sterling, the owner. And it's a very, you know, the NBA dynamics are very, very complicated in this sense. Of course, Doc Rivers is going to go where he's going to get the most money, or where he sees not only the opportunity to get a large paycheck, but the opportunity to mold a potential championship-winning team. And he went and he seized upon that opportunity, even though he knew full well what the personality of Donald Sterling is and what Donald Sterling is capable of and what his past record is.
Yeah, look, this is about unoriginal thoughts, and I'm about to do one. Talk about the power of money. He'll pay him $7 million, so Rivers is willing to swallow what he knows and live with it, which is his right. The NAACP is about to give him a lifetime achievement award.
That's the one that's you know, absolutely crazy.
Because obviously he's funded.
The second time they're giving him an award.
And by the way, for those, it was supposed to happen on May 15th, and after this thing broke, they courageously decided to withdraw the offer of the Lifetime Achievement Award. The way you denied housing to black people was so beautifully crafted, Donald Sterling. We think we'll give you a lifetime achievement. I mean, it is pathetic.
With that?
Money. It's all about money.
Well, I would recommend a story, a column that Frank Bruni wrote in the New York Times today, and he summarized this whole relationship as cash for karma.
That's
really what it is. You know, there are these, you know, high net worth individuals who are just throwing money at causes, at people to kind of burnish their reputation, or in this case, reverse their image of what, you know, this guy who's a known racist when it comes to his housing policies is, I believe, spending time with inner city children, donating money. This is Donald Sterling to programs for inner city children and getting recognition as a result from the NAACP. So, you know, this is, you know, what Bruni says is karma for cash or cash for karma.
So last thing, and let's go back to what we said a minute ago. Assuming you're right about what Adam Silver does at 2 o'clock today, the new commissioner of the NBA, and it's an indefinite suspension. We're going to investigate this thoroughly, and if we find out, whatever. Is that going to be enough of an end of the story for the players? Forget, just stay with the players for a minute. Or is this just one little bump in the road?
I don't think anything will be enough for the players. I mean,
as long as he's still there.
I think as long as he's still there. Without him getting, you know, being pushed out of his ownership, I don't think anything will be enough. But it will be interesting to see what happens, because I've seen times in the NBA's past where players get all riled up and, you know, really want to take action, whether it's a social cause that's outside of the NBA or something that happens within the NBA community. Trayvon Martin was one such example where I believe the Miami Heat posed with hoodies, and basically said, "I am Trayvon Martin." There are times, but, you know, it sort of has it burns very hot and then sort of dies. So I'd be interested to see if this sort of, I don't want to say opens the eyes of the players, but makes them more socially active and more aware of certain issues within society, and they take a longer-term view, and it doesn't just sort of burn hot and then fade away.
Well, you know, the way it keeps burning hot is if the Clippers win two of the next three games and go to the next round.
Exactly.
If they lose in this first round of the playoffs, then obviously the profile of this whole thing is going to diminish. But we're speaking to Shira Springer from the Boston Globe sports pages.
Okay, well, let's move on to one of the most
cheerier subjects.
Bizarre stories I've read in quite some time. Please detail for us, Shira, the plight of the Buffalo Jills. They are cheerleaders for the Buffalo Bills football team. Bills and Jills, I guess that's the deal.
How clever.
So they've sued. What's it all about?
Well, basically, they're suing because the cheerleaders, there's the squad of, I believe it's 35 cheerleaders, but only a few of them are suing because they believe they were underpaid, not given minimum wage if you put together all the hours they work. And also, they're saying that there were some discriminatory practices or basically degrading practices. We can enumerate them, but the ones that stick out is sort of being told how to behave in public, such things as do not eat carbs at public banquets. But the most appalling would be fairly explicit instructions on feminine hygiene that they were to follow.
Unbelievable. They were subjected to weekly physique evaluations during
jiggle
which
tests.
tested their bodies for jiggling. Now, listen, I'm on the side of these women. This is ridiculous. On the other hand, having gone to a few New England Patriots games in my life, the whole idea of these women cheerleading on the side,
I'm so glad you're saying
is
this,
so demeaning and degrading. And I hope somebody gets an acting career out of this or something. Or is it just getting up there and being, you know?
We live in a Kardashian world. I mean, I think it's all about getting attention.
Do they ever go anywhere from being on the sidelines, making kind of fools of themselves?
I'm not sure, you know, Patriots cheerleader or Buffalo Jills cheerleader is a stepping stone to a larger media career.
Yeah.
Though there was a period in time not too long ago when being a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, and that's sort
huge,
of like
right.
the gold standard. Yeah. They had specials on TV. I mean, that, you know, came with a reality TV package. I mean, that was considered, you know, a stepping stone to a larger career.
But are these, for them, I'm not familiar with the Buffalo Jills, I must admit. But, you know, a lot of the cheerleading you see in, for example, college is unbelievably athletic. I mean, they're doing stuff that is almost as athletic, if not more, than the people who are doing the sport which they're cheering for. The sense I get, this is only anecdotal, so you correct me if I'm wrong, this is an eye candy deal. And that's, I mean, isn't that what essentially it is in the pros?
I would agree with you, and I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, they've suspended activities for the Buffalo Jills, but I have to wonder, honestly, how much longer we'll have professional football cheerleaders? Because it just seems to me, if you've been to a game these
days,
well, it's awful, but they have, you know, the Jumbotron, they have, you know, all sorts of other entertainment. Yeah. I mean, soon you're going to have in your seat sort of your own kind of like iPad type home, you know, video system that you can actually in a stadium seat. So there's going to be all sorts of entertainment at your hand, and to have these distant cheerleaders that you can barely pick out unless you're watching them on the Jumbotron. You know, it just doesn't seem to make sense. It seems like an outdated mode of entertainment.
Yeah, but we should be clear that Marjorie has said repeatedly off the air, if she could see Tom Brady in one of those costumes, she'd be all in favor, whether they made minimum wage or not.
I do know one person who went on to have a spectacular
career
after being a New England Patriots.
Who is that?
That's Wendy Murphy. She was a cheerleader.
Is she parlaying her experience as a Patriots cheerleader into her current job? No.
No, she is not. She's absolutely not.
Shira, before you go, and I feel, well, I don't know if I feel bad or not, that I made a Rosie Ruiz reference. Rosie Ruiz is the woman, if you remember, decades ago who didn't run the marathon. My favorite thing is the T-shirt that has a subway token on it representing Rosie Ruiz, essentially taking a subway and then running. I use the term loosely. Was it Bill Rogers who won that race where he's looking at her thighs? There's a photograph of whoever won the men's race looking at Rosie Ruiz sitting next to him.
I thought it was with a guy with black hair.
I'm not sure. Looking and essentially
Frank
saying, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Whoever it was, in essence.
I mean, runners know other runners.
Yeah, she did not look like...
No one ever heard of her. But putting that aside for a second, is this much ado about not much, or is this a bigger issue? This whole story about some people running with fake bibs. The guy, the founder of Foursquare, is one of them. He did one for his wife. He was running one at her run. How big a deal is this, and how upset should we be about this?
I think the fact that there were people running with other people's numbers is a very big deal within the running community. I think the bigger deal outside the running community is the fact that these people got through security.
Yeah.
You know, all of this talk about
point,
tight security, tight security, tight security, and then people were making their own mock bibs and getting past. I mean, I had to show my bib number 4 times to get into my starting
corral. Oh, I totally forgot, by the way. So...
Yes.
How
it was good.
I forgot. I'm so embarrassed. I forgot about you. And not about, I didn't forget about you at all. I forgot about you as marathon runner. What was the day like?
It was pretty incredible. I mean, it was a wild experience. I think the thing that I took away from it that was different from all the other marathons that I've ever run is that everybody was saying thank you to everybody else.
That's great.
I mean,
that's,
you know,
really
I was
great.
Walking to the start with a guy from South Africa, and he was thanking every officer, every National Guards person. And, you know, the runners were saying thank you to the spectators as they ran by. The spectators were saying thank you for coming to Boston. Thank you for making, you know, the race again. Thank you for coming back. I mean, that was pretty cool. The whole way you heard thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
One of my favorite thank you stories, I'm sure you know this, I had Ambie Burfoot on television with me a couple of weeks ago. He's one of the founders of Runner's World. He won the marathon in 68, 7 years before his college roommate, who happened to be Bill Rogers, who won it. And he had printed himself this thing he typed on his computer, little thank you cards. He printed 200 thank you cards and handed them out. I showed you one, Marjorie, and handed them out to people on the sidelines. There was such a humble, real, for a former champion of the race, I thought
there was a lot
beautiful in so many ways.
Of that going around. You know, not probably as extreme as handing out cards, but a lot of people. I saw people posing with spectators before the race and taking selfies with the spectators, you know, and like saying, oh, I'll email this to you. I mean, you don't have this usually before someone's about to run a marathon.
Yeah, well, that's pretty neat.
On running,
Shira,
it's great to see you as always.
Thank you very much for being here with us. As always, Shira Springer, thank you very much. Shira Springer talks to about, we already talked to Shira Springer. We're going to move on now, and she's the Sports and Enterprise Investigative Reporter for the Boston Globe.
Good to see you.
Congratulations again, Shira.
Thanks.
Up next, could the answer to income inequality come not from raising the minimum wage, but by enforcing a maximum wage? What would happen if the government put a cap on how much the 1% earned? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Next time on The World, invisible ink. It's not kid stuff.
People actually use this to send secret messages.
This historian knows the chemical formulas and secret methods used for hiding messages. Stories about ancient Greek scribes, modern-day spies.
One of my favorites is a Nazi spy who hid invisible ink in his molar.
What you don't know about secret writing, that's on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Wolf Greenfield, specializing in intellectual property law,
supporting the business and economic news show Marketplace, weekdays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH Radio. And 10,000 Villages, offering fairly traded scarves, jewelry, and cards for Mother's Day, locations in Brookline, Cambridge, and Downtown Crossing, as well as Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Cranston, Rhode Island. 10,000villages.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As Marjorie said to John King about an hour or so ago, Harry Reid tomorrow, the leader of the Senate, is pushing a higher minimum wage vote to the floor. Good populist move, but one that may not do much to bridge the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. Instead, we want to ask you, should our lawmakers be agitating to push a maximum wage? What would it mean if the government put a cap on how much corporate executives could earn? Could tethering top execs pay to some sort of concrete measurement stop American executives from floating further into the stratosphere? Will there be more shared experiences, which would be good for a small D democracy? Don't call us and say it's not going to happen. We understand if they're not going to raise the minimum wage, it's not likely that Republicans and Democrats are going to get together. We want to talk
miracles,
conceptually.
Miracles, Jim.
The number is 877-301-8970. Before you dismiss this out of hand, let's, Marjorie and I will share some statistics with you if we can. In this piece we read, the average CEO in this country makes 273 times as much as the average worker. Not the, that's not minimum wage. That's the average wage earner in America. Since 1978, this is my favorite, the average CEO salary has gone up 875%. Mm-hmm. The average salaried employee's wage has gone up 5.4%. over the same 36 years, which makes a case that there's a widening divide.
Right. They also talk about there's some outliers. That's not. Some people are even more extraordinary than that. This guy that runs JCPenney, he makes 1,795 times the average wage and benefits of a U.S. department store worker. But their premise is, if you said, okay, let's say that 1,795 times is too much or 273 times is too much, how about we just say make the maximum pay 200 times the minimum. So that would raise the maximum to $3 million a year for the person that
under
was
the current minimum wage,
at the top. Yeah. I mean, $3 million a year. But if you think that's kind of stingy, we don't want these CEOs to just have to squeak by on $3 million a year, we could peg the maximum to 1,000 times the minimum wage, and that would bring them to $15 million a year. Now, that's a lot of money.
They got to feed their families, Marjorie.
$15 million a year. That's the theory that you could get by on $15 million a year, and everybody would have a higher wage at the bottom and a more moderate wage at the top, unlike this guy at some place called this California Medical Supply Company, McKesson, where his total compensation in 2011 was $131.2 million.
Well, Tim Cook made $1 billion 2 years ago at Apple. I mean, please. You know, the motivation for this is not just that some of us see the disparity is obscene. Put that aside because I know it upsets some people. The point is made in this article, and I don't even know who wrote it, is there's no shared experience between people at that stratospheric level and mere mortals. They don't live in literally and figuratively in the same world. They're private police operations as opposed to, you know, the whole deal, private schools versus, and John Edwards, who almost never quote, I mean, it is the two Americas kind of thing. And it's not, as you said, it's not like these proposals would ask people to be living on starvation wages. By the way, I was stunned by this fact. In Switzerland, the people got to vote on a nationwide referendum to limit the executive pay, what was it, 10 times or 12 times, I think, what the average wage earner made, and it was rejected by a 2-to-1 margin, 66 to 34%. But the point is that some people are talking about this, and at minimum, even though it's not going to happen in the near future, let's put it that way, at minimum, it gets a conversation going. The notion that you need 273 times as much money in salary or benefits or whatever as the average worker in your place is an abomination.
Well, it's all what we were talking about before with the appeal of Elizabeth Warren, all about this income inequality and the middle class getting hammered and all this new economic research that's basically saying we're moving toward an oligarchy in the United States of America where, you know, the wealthy elites, as the story says, are exercising more power over the political process than ordinary citizens. This guy, Thomas Piketty, I always mispronounce
Piketty,
his name.
Yeah, Piketty, that's right.
Oh, I got it right. Okay. Anyway, I mean, his book talking about the fact that this is the logical outcome, this massive inequality, is the logical outcome of capitalism, and that World War II and World War I and other circumstances may have changed things in the 20th century, but we are now going back to what capitalism naturally produces, is this huge income gap. And I think people are feeling this in their regular lives all the time. And by the way, there's also been a lot of great social science research talking about exactly what you just said, that if you were very wealthy and you fly first class, or you never have to wait for a parking space because you have someone drop you off in your limousine, mm-hmm. you don't do your own shopping, your kids don't have to go to the public schools, you never have, you don't mix it up with the regular Joe and Jane, that your empathy level goes way down. If you do have a chance to spend a day, say, in a homeless shelter or in a poor kid's school, by the end of the day, your empathy level is through the roof because you don't confront this, you don't understand it.
You don't have to be in a homeless shelter. If you spend a day taking the subway, if you spend a day living in a small apartment, and you know, there's another great point about tying the maximum wage to the minimum wage as opposed to the average wage. It would provide an incentive for the richest people in America to support what?
Exactly.
An increase in the minimum wage because their salaries would go up too. Again, we know it is a pipe dream, but at least we felt we'd spend a few minutes talking to you. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Let's go to David in Newton. David, what do you think?
Well, I think I love the discussion about sort of creating some more equality, but I think really we should emphasize creating a middle class in much the way we did after World War II. And I think the notion of capping that top end of where people can go if they are successful, as Jim said, it's a non-starter, but I think we should really spend our time sort of like what Elizabeth Warren's talking about, creating programs that will actually give people a chance to step up and you'll always have haves and have-nots, but maybe have some more, have some.
Yeah, but David, I agree with you with one caveat. Statistics like those which we are reciting, which we've been reading, about CEO salary going up 875% over the last 35 years while salaried employees saw their income go up 5%, helps create a fertile territory for reform for the middle class, whether it's Elizabeth Warren inspired or whomever it's inspired by. So I think the backdrop for this provided by the person, by the way, it's from theweek.com that we saw this, is really useful. David, thanks for the call.
Well, also the tax rates after World War II were through the roof for the wealthiest people. I mean, they were much, much higher than they are now. And
that's Piketty's solution, is worldwide global income tax. We discussed it with Nancy Kane, who's going to be with us in a couple of minutes.
Yeah,
but it's not happening.
They were way up there, 70, 75%, those sort of tax rates.
90%.
90%, which people are not very interested in now, but that was sort of one of the reasons that the middle class was allowed to grow and thrive. Sean from Denham. What do you think, Sean?
Hey, guys. A couple of things. But Jimmy, I know it's a theory. Of course, if you could tax it, Jimmy, you'd be all over this. But why are we going to penalize people for hard work? I mean, why not look into how many healthy, able people are on government assistance, i.e. EBT, WIC?
No, we know, but we know, Sean, we know you're doing that, so that's taken care of. But, Sean, you raised what I wasn't even going to raise because it aggravates me so much, but since you were kind enough to bring it up, the implication that the reason CEOs make 273 times as much as you do, Sean, is because they work harder. Do you work hard?
Up every day and go to work, sometimes 6-7 days a week to pay the bills.
Right.
Exactly.
Aggravating for workers like myself when people, you go to the grocery store and you hear stories like, oh, the guy, the first card was empty, so they go to the second EBT card, or then they pull out $1,000 in cash, and then they get out to the parking lot and they're at Cadillac SUV. Who the hell pays for that?
But Sean, you know something? I love you, but you're a big sap. You are a big sap. Your problem is not the EBT people. Your problem are the people that are making 273 times what you're making and are shafting you. I mean, that's what's going on. The EBT card people are getting poorer and poorer, and these people are making, $200 million a year, getting richer and richer, and the middle class is going nowhere.
She called you a big sap, Sean.
With all due respect, Sean, I mean, to blame the EBT cards is sort of, you're missing the boat here, Sean.
How about it, Sean?
What if their deal is, I see on a daily basis the other end of life, the people in the EBT who are healthy people who can work.
Okay.
I don't see the millionaires and the billionaires because I work for a living. I'm in the trenches.
Yeah.
You'll never see them.
I don't mind being where I am. I'm working. I don't mind working. I love it, but
it really brings me down when I see people who are very able and they sit around and they almost mock you because, oh, you've got to work for it.
You know, Sean, in a serious note, and we've been discussing this with you on the radio for years, the implication, and it is implicit in your criticism of it, and you've been relentless to your credit, I think. I mean, you believe in something and you spread the message. Is the implication, everything you say, is that people who are getting some sort of government benefit are loving every minute of it. They don't want a decent job. They don't want a decent wage. They're always outliers. They're always people who are messing with the system, just like their executives who hire high-priced accountants to make sure that they pay at a lower tax rate than you do. Oh, Sean's gone. In any case, 877-301-8970. We didn't hang up on him. We actually love Sean. We've known him
through
the radio for years and years.
I didn't mean to call him
years.
A sap. But I
no, you called
feel
him a big sap.
In this situation, I think he's looking at the wrong end.
You know,
but he's
I hung
right.
Up,
those
he probably
people.
Is going to seek counsel, Marjorie. I'd get a good lawyer if I were you,
okay.
Fast.
I'm sorry. Let's go to Tom in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Tom.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I certainly think that maximum wage is certainly fodder for discussion. It's a difficult reach. However, in the 50s, as you mentioned, 91% taxes, and Arthur Godfrey, he joked about it once in a while, but he didn't look like he was struggling.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, it also is an incentive for wealthy people to donate more of their money to a worthwhile charity.
Well, I don't think, by the way, I don't think there's anybody who's proposing a return to 90% rates. Most people, including people who work full time on issues of income inequality, think it's confiscatory. But having the rates in the mid-30s for the wealthiest people and the ability to do things to lower their tax rate is even – what's the great line from Warren Buffett? He paid at a lower rate than his secretary.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the nature of the system as it currently exists, which is unfortunate. Tom, thank you for the call. Well, you know, this
but,
is
you know,
one
as
of
long
these
– I'm
sorry.
As long as he was talking about the 50s, I mean, it's a cliche to point out, but I'll point it out anyway, that in the 1950s or 60s, if your father went to work at a regular job, you know, he was a salesman or maybe he was a clerk at the hardware store, something like that, you could buy a house.
No,
you
you're
could
right.
like
you're
you could like
right.
go on a little vacation, a little modest vacation to Cape Cod. You could send your kids to college. You could do all these things. And now, especially in Boston, you know, $100,000 used to be a lot of money. Try raising a family of two or three kids on $100,000 in Boston.
Well, there's also
that's a lot of money, but it's not enough anymore.
There was also something very different. Not only the money, as you talked about, but there was also a much greater sense of loyalty from the employer to his or her employees and vice versa that doesn't exist now. And one of the reasons you could afford to buy that home is because you know you're going to have your job. I mean, even if it turns out it was a little less than you needed to buy that first house or that second house, the likelihood is good is you could work there if you worked hard and were honest for as long as you wanted. That's a totally different dynamic. But the fact this spread, and I know that Sean was partially tongue-in-cheek, but that is the prevailing notion against any sort of great equalizer, is they work hard for their money. And it's often said by people like Sean, and by the way, we're not bad-mouthing Sean behind his back. We said the same thing to him as Marjorie just did, by people who are working themselves to the bone and are talking about these CEOs in literal or figurative gated communities. I mean, it's just, you know, some of the examples, this writer, whoever it was that did this thing in theweek.com, talk about people. I mean, how about the former head of Blue Cross? Who left here, his name, Cleve
Killingsworth,
who presided over some of the worst years of Blue Cross in terms of membership and revenues. He leaves. What did he get? A $10
million
wet kiss on the way out the door? I mean, it's unbelievable.
And they mentioned the story of this guy from Yahoo, Henrique DeCastro. He collected $60 million severance package from Yahoo when he was fired as the company's chief operating officer after only a year or a little bit more than a year on the job.
So what was the total? How much
did
he make?
Annual salary of $40 million, bringing
his
total compensation $109 million.
Yeah, but can I tell you something?
For 15 months,
the guy worked like a dog.
Worked like a dog.
He worked like a dog. And if $2 million a week is not what you should get paid for working like a dog, I don't know what it is. One more quick one, and then we got to go. Ralph, you're in Framingham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about maximum wage as a concept. Hi.
I think it's a great idea, and my big frustration with issues like this is how one side of things would completely dominate the conversation, even though they're completely wrong. For example, they call high taxes wealth redistribution, when in reality, all a high tax would do is distribute the wealth back to the people who earned it. Right now, the income inequality gap is a great example of wealth being redistributed out of the middle class. You've got people like Sean who fall for the line that if you're on food stamps, you're a welfare queen. Never mind that GD doesn't pay taxes and they make millions of dollars. And they, their employees, you know, their entry-level employees, like, say, a McDonald's employee, is on welfare, even though the company is profitable. And I'd like to end with the question of when was the last time a Republican was right about anything?
I actually, there, you had me totally until the last sentence, but thank you, Ralph, for your thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay, up next, Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to talk about animal liberation. When it comes to legal rights, what do members of the animal community deserve? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Next time on The Takeaway, we're talking about the Fourth Amendment. It's all about search and seizure and smartphones.
Checking my sources. I'm always learning new things.
The Supreme Court hears arguments on whether law enforcement officers can search the phones of a person arrested. We look at how the law changes with the technology of the times. Plus all the day's news and your comments. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Fox Hill Village of Westwood, providing retirement living and cooperative ownership to active seniors for over 20 years, including White Oak Cottages, its new concept in memory care. FoxHillVillage.com and WhiteOakCottages.com. And Skinner, presenting clocks, watches, and scientific instruments at auction Saturday, May 3rd at the Skinner Marlborough Gallery, featuring historic arms and militaria. Lecture Friday evening, May 2nd. More info at SkinnerInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday for open mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, even though we won't be saying that much longer, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, it's great to see you.
Always great to be here.
Hi, Nancy. So we're going to talk about this great piece from the Times Magazine. The headline was, Should a Chimp Be Able to Sue Its Owner? And it's all about, or most of it is about, this attorney named Stephen Wise. So tell us about Stephen Wise, please, Nancy.
So Mr. Wise is a very interesting lawyer. And he has been systematically for more than 15 years trying to build a field of law that sits in the broader pasture of animal welfare, but is really much more focused literally on animal rights, and particularly on rights that legally, you know, traditionally by precedent, by practice in the legal system, have been oriented around the concept of personhood. So he is trying to literally eke out a space in the courtrooms of this country around how can you file, you know, in some sense, you know, legal action on behalf of animals that whose rights are being, by his and by many, many people's measures, by measures that we would apply to human beings, are being infringed. And he's not arguing that all rights obtain to humans obtain to animals. He's arguing that certain rights all of us would agree, right, all of us would agree, forgive that little interrogative, are obligations of decency towards sentient beings, including or focused on intelligent animals. So he has chosen very strategically, he's a very strategic thinker in this very interesting article called Should a Chimp Be Able to Sue Its Owner? In last week's Times Magazine by Charles Siebert is a reporter. He's arguing that, you know, he's focused on very, very intelligent animals. So this is, he literally filed suit on behalf of a chimp that was held in a
dungeon.
Tommy was the name of the chimp. Many people would say cruel circumstances. And he filed suit on habeas corpus. He chose that kind of suit to file very specifically because the law, common law, this is not federal law. It's harder to do all kinds of things in federal law because the standards of proof are higher and the standards of bringing a suit to trial or to a judge are higher. So he's choosing to focus on issues around habeas corpus, filing on behalf of a certain person as, in a sense, as a right to bring trial. And he filed suit on behalf of Tommy, that Tommy was being kept in circumstances that were, you know, were basic that were in basic disregard of his rights to a certain kind of life. In this case, captivity.
I want to underline something you said. The lawsuit was filed in conjunction with a group called the Non-Human Rights Project. They filed a bunch of lawsuits in New York State, which they thought was the most fertile jurisdiction for this because they did an analysis of judges, that sort of thing. The most important point, I think, is the one you mentioned up front, Nancy. The reason they picked chimps is because, as the piece says, they have higher order cognitive abilities. They have a sense of past and future. Essentially, they're the most like humans, and that's how they decided to pick them. Ultimately, they want to deal with dolphins and orcas
and
others.
Right.
But essentially, their contention is that this is not an issue of animal protection, which is on the move in this country. In fact, there was a high-profile bill just filed at the State House to expand protection of animals in the wake of the puppy doe thing out of Quincy a couple of months ago, another horrible incident a few weeks ago. But essentially, that they have rights. They have rights that humans have. How do you find that as a proposition?
Well, I find it, you know, manifestly obvious in some sense. I went back to my copy of Darwin, which I haven't really opened. Not Origin of Species, his most famous work, a work that followed that's equally important called Descent of Man, which is about the relationship between man and mammals, and man and all kinds of animals. And he has a whole chapter. I actually went back literally and read it. I see my handwriting from like 25 years ago. Oh, I was a graduate student.
And
my handwriting, I noticed, is
that's
different.
Great.
But literally, let me just read you one sentence. This is from the second page of Chapter 3, The Comparison of the Mental Powers of Man and the Lower Animals. My object in this chapter, remember, he's a scientist. He's not a member of PETA, right? He had dogs, but, you know, this is a man of science who took a long, sweet time about getting Origin of Species out, but never lacked, right, for the will to collect the needed evidence based on the scientific record. So my object in this chapter is to show that there's no fundamental difference between man and the higher mammals in their mental faculties. So I actually read this entire chapter last night. It's in tiny little print in my, like, you know, modern library edition of like 1938. and he goes through all these different aspects of what we think of as mental faculties: reason, curiosity, memory, imagination, ability to problem solve. He literally goes through them page by page, where each of those faculties is in italics. He stops at belief in God, but he doesn't stop at sense of beauty. And he has all these interesting examples from Arctic dogs that figure out on thin ice that they don't actually want to travel in a straight line. If they're pulling a sled, they want to fan out because they're less likely to pull the sled, break the ice.
Really?
To these amazing stories that he's observed. Remember, this is not a typical animal lover. This is a scientist who wants to make his name in a brand new field.
Right.
And is looking for evidence that substantiates a theory about the origin of man. And so he has all these examples to, you know, animals that can completely solve these complicated problems. And so I think it's very, very hard for anyone that, you know, is awake to think that animals, you know, have no relationship to man, and that there's this dark line between human beings and, say, chimpanzees, or chimpanzees and dolphins, or dolphins and elephants. Let's be reasonable. These are creatures with great capacity. And last comment, whether we want to go as far as saying these creatures have rights that we need to line up or delineate or somehow, you know, carve a subset out of a larger, much larger list of rights for human beings, you know, whether we want to do that or not, I think the really interesting question is this question, and it's not mine. It goes all the way back to Jeremy Bentham, right, pre-Darwin, the philosopher and moralist who wrote about prisons, he wrote about all kinds of moral issues. And he said the question is less do they think, right, or what is their mental capacity? Because it's entirely possible to argue, as many, many people have, that a child that is born with severe, or a human being that has severely constrained, right, mental capacity can have less intelligence on lots of different measures than a highly functioning chimp. So again, we're in slippery slope here. But Bentham argues the question isn't what are their mental faculties? The question isn't are they like us? The question around these kind of issues is can they suffer? So I think that, and I'm not, you know, I'm not the first person to look at that question. That's an important question.
But they can all suffer.
So,
the place where you lose me on this, I think, and where Stephen Wise loses me, I completely agree with 99% of what you said. Those animals which can suffer, obviously, are entitled to some protection. But this is this guy Richard Epstein, who's quoted right. in the story from NYU. Who has
a legal scholar
has utter contempt for Stephen Wise. It's pretty clear. He says something I can't find.
He didn't have to say, I don't think he's a great intellect.
He says,
did he really have to go
there?
He's
a man of tremendous...
Even though that was exactly that,
he says, my attitude is this, which is exactly where I am. I mean, I agree with all the things you said about suffering, and they are animals just like we are animals. My attitude, says Richard Epstein, is there are two ways to think about this. He thinks of it as rights, just meaning Stephen Wise.
That's his right. That's
I think
his chosen
about it
territory.
As protection.
Right.
And in light of the fact, and the reason I think about it as protection too, is let's assume this chimp were to win its suit. And by the way, they lost all their litigation in the lower court. They knew they were. They wanted to establish a record, and then they're going to the appellate courts right. in New York State. But even if they were to win on behalf of Tommy, the chimp doesn't go free. The chimp gets humane protection, right. humane treatment. So isn't that the issue, protection, not rights? Why are you having a bird over there?
Because I think, obviously, I mean, many of us have seen the Blackfish CNN documentary about the orcas that are at SeaWorld, which are highly...
Very controversial film.
Very controversial film, that's right. But what they argued in that film is that these orcas are very social animals. They're taken away from their families. They're living these lives of misery, and that's why they go around killing trainers when their frustration builds up. So... no one is the animal protection laws would not help the orcas.
So expand the animal protection laws.
Well, I don't know.
Just like
maybe,
it's being proposed on Beacon Hill.
So let's take a step back from rights. Let's look at Stephen Wise as someone who's decided here's some landscape that may be fertile. That I can plow and plant on in the interest, call it protection, call it rights. I'm not sure the language actually matters so much. And I can imagine Richard Posner getting all anxious about whether this becomes part of the legal landscape, because that's going to be it's going to create a whole class of lawyers and stuff in the courts and whatnot. But the issue is still about how do we, as a society, and we're a society that lags behind Europe and some other parts of the world in thinking about this, ahead of China, but behind a lot of Europe
Russians.
In thinking about, you know, what is serious, viable, you know, effective, and also practicable protection.
I agree.
Okay, so I think, you know, so one thing that happens is if Stephen Wise gets traction and his non-human rights project begins to gather steam, as it clearly is, for all kinds of reasons that aren't really less about rights and more about our increasing knowledge and awareness of what our living, or the way we live, what that means for a bunch of creatures. So if he gets traction, then, you know, the end result is less that I think we're going to have a whole lot of lawyers and a new field of law. We will have it. But that we will get people that are serious about enforcing the protection laws.
Well, I agree. But I think you're mischaracterizing Stephen Wise. I don't know him. I'm just reading
about
him.
No, nor do I.
My sense is he's not about compromise. I think you're speaking practically. That may be the consequence. And I think if that's the case, that's a good thing.
Yep.
But my sense is he's a take no prisoners kind of thing. By the way, just as one aside, Marjorie and I both remarked on this, and this does not have anything to do with what you brought to us today, Nancy Kane. David Frank from Mass Lawyers Weekly, whenever he's here, we get in a big, not a fight with him, a discussion about why can't judges talk about cases in Massachusetts, which would be far better for public understanding and whatever. There is a beautiful interview here with this Judge Size, S-I-S-E, where while he
Joseph
ruled
Size.
While he ruled against Stephen Wise, he explains in a way that the public can understand why he decided to rule as he did, which completely, in my view, helps public understanding of
Absolutely.
What's going on in the courtroom.
Absolutely.
But in Massachusetts, they're mute, which is a whole topic for another day.
Absolutely. So, you know, I was sitting in the green room before I walked into the studio thinking about why, in the broad sweep of history, are we suddenly, as a world, as a global village, starting to think about these kind of issues with new intensity and new edge, right? Why is there a PETA? Right. A P.S., by the way, just as a historical footnote, you know, we may think, many of us and many of our listeners may think that Stephen Weiss is, you know, a hard-nosed, take-no-prisoners, slightly wacky zealot. They said the same thing about Mary Wollstonecraft in 1792 when she was arguing for the rights of women. Right. They said the same thing about Susan B. Anthony. They said the same thing about Martin Luther King. They said the same thing about the early gay rights activists. So remember, the way a lot of people, including Posner, think about someone like Stephen Weiss is very similar to other kinds of activists pushing.
Do you think we're going to look back on Stephen Weiss in 50 years and say he was the Martin Luther King of his generation?
Close down the
zoos. I do not. But I think that, well, we already are saying that about Peter Singer, who's a much bigger figure in animal liberation than Weiss probably will ever be. And he is now considered an absolutely, Animal Liberation, 1975, fascinating book. Peter Singer, a philosopher at Princeton, still, right? He's written all kinds of stuff on all kinds of moral issues.
You know what I learned in this endless piece in the New York Times magazine, which, and I meant that for emphasis, it is great, but it is long, is while the issue now is essentially can an animal with high cognitive abilities be a plaintiff, essentially, so that it has a certain set of rights?
And what do they wear?
What I didn't know is
courtroom,
starting in the Middle Ages up until the early 1900s, in civilized society, animals were defendants in criminal cases all over the case, charged with crimes. A pig was sentenced to death. Where was it? In the UK in 1906, because it participated in some crime, and the judge said that were not for the pig, the person wouldn't be dead. I mean, were you surprised? Did you know that?
So again, let me go back to my original, like, large kind of picture historian's observation. So I was thinking, so yes, I mean, I was surprised by that, but you know, I mean, the common law emerged, right, from people trying to, you know, settle and find solutions to all kinds of issues of living in common together, including the critical importance of animals in everyday life in a way many of us, with the exception of our pets, and that's not a small exception, we can't have any access to anymore because we don't live in the land and we don't live with animals and we don't kill our own meat.
Right.
So I was thinking, why is it suddenly that suddenly there's this kind of, we can feel it growing, this momentum around even things like factory farming, right, which is the greatest perpetrator of unspeakable cruelty every single day, for every single minute.
I'm dying to hear the answer. It's
so
a great
here's
question.
So I was thinking, so why is it? So I think it's because until the mid-19th century, maybe a little bit later, almost all people all over the world lived with animals. They ate their own, they killed their own meat, whether it was pigs or fish or beef or sheep or goats. They killed it, right? They lived with it. Until 1700, in lots of parts of Europe, animals actually literally lived in the house for warmth in a section of a big grass or log hut. So it's only been in the last 120 years that people have separated themselves from animals. And that the scale of production and resource needs have grown so large that we are impinging, right? We talked about the sixth extinction last week, that are pushing and crowding into wildlife. We never had medical testing and medical research on animals until the 20th century. This is a brand new, speaking from a historian standpoint, issue. And like women, right, coming to public consciousness and their demand for rights, it calls for a conversation and some action.
Okay, so let's predict. You think about your historian. Where are we 50 years from now on this whole issue?
When we have you back on Boston Public Radio in 50 years, Marjorie asks you a question.
After four facelifts, right, and some really zippy go-go boots, because I intend to be a very, very zippy, you know, 90-year-old.
In that get-up, what are you going to say?
When you're back here at 90, what
I mean, do you remember back in the, you know, at the early 21st century when we actually, like, you know, cut chickens' feet off and put them in tiny little boxes and tried to fatten them as fast as we could and, you know, clip their beaks so they wouldn't peck, and kept animals, cows confined in, you know, 4x6 boxes for all their life. Do you remember that? Do you remember that's actually how we used to do it? Can you imagine?
So we have 30 seconds. Your point is we've come so far, so fast. Is that where you're going with this, that it's not unreasonable to think that we get to the point somewhere near where Stephen Weiss once in the next 50 years?
I don't know if it's Stephen Weiss. I think it's just where we all actually wake up and look at the real costs. We may all still eat meat, but we look at the real costs of some of the everyday choices we make all over the world 24/7, or as my personal trainer used to like to say,
all day, every day.
Well, I hope you're right.
You said it beautifully, too.
I always feel bad when you
great.
Go to the zoos and you see the animals in the zoo, and they always look so depressed.
Well, nobody, very few people are defending that, by the way.
Okay.
Can they suffer? Animal Liberation 1975. Don't pass go. Don't collect $200. Take a look at it.
Thank you.
Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Great to see you. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for medical ethicist Art Kaplan and film critic Garen Daly. Also, we forgot to mention yesterday that veterinarian and author Nick Trout will be at the Weston Public Library tomorrow night at 7 for a reading of his new book. Our show's production of WGBH, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Will Roslip, and John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.